Hey everybody, I'm Scott Horton, and this is my very first show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I want to thank Paul for being the producer. I'm really happy to be on the Republic Broadcasting Network to do what I think I'm going to continue to call the Weekend Interview Show, and I'm going to go ahead and get the Weekend Interview Show started off correctly, I hope, with a favorite of mine. He is the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Interpress Service, and is one of the world's most foremost experts on the neoconservatives. So welcome to the show, Mr. Jim Loeb.
Oh, thank you.
It's an honor to have you on as my first guest, sir.
Well, I guess it's an honor to be the first guest.
Okay, well, I'm looking at the news, and I see that the most moderate force in Iraq, Ayatollah al-Sistani, is in London with heart problems, and the next most powerful Shia leader in the south of Iraq, al-Sadr, has started a new uprising, or I don't know who started it, but there's a new uprising going on in the south, the tenuous truce apparently coming to an end. And I guess I'm thinking that as I'm looking at these headlines and I'm seeing what a disaster the invasion of Iraq is turning out to be, that maybe some of us need a reminder about exactly how we got into this mess in the first place. And that's where you come in, sir.
Okay,
so who are these neoconservatives, and what's so different about them than the rest of the foreign policy elite in the United States?
Well, for one thing, they've been more or less on the margins of the foreign policy elite for most of the 35 years that they've been a kind of movement. And it's really only since although I should say they were quite influential during the first term of Ronald Reagan. They've really only reached the zenith of their influence since 9/11, and I think the zenith may be past. That's something maybe we can talk a little bit later. But essentially, the neoconservatives come in to the picture in the late 60s and early 70s from the left. That is, their antecedents are more or less with the Democratic Party, a lot with the labor union movement. Some of the earlier maybe prefigurers of neoconservatism were at one time considered themselves Trotskyites. And in fact, a number
after,
of them were,
after Trotsky, the founder of the Red Army.
Right. Although by that time, Trotsky was no longer the head of the Red Army. And he had gone into exile. And there were a number of Trotskyites who were quite close to Trotsky himself, really, who began moving right and becoming very identified very strongly with the United States. One of them was a man named Max Schachtman, and I'm really not an expert on things Trotskyite, but Schachtman at one time was Trotsky's main representative in the United States. And he became, largely because of an very, very fervent anti-Stalinism, became increasingly to see the United States as the main force against Stalinism and the Soviet Union. And he provoked a number of splits within the Trotskyite movement in the United States, ending more or less with something called Social Democrats USA. And a lot of neoconservatives who are now quite prominent have spent time in Social Democrats USA, and many of them, well, not many of them, but a number of them continue to be members of Social Democrats USA.
So in the late 60s, when the new the new left movement came, the hippies and all that kind of thing, that's when these guys broke from the traditional way of being leftist and started their movement rightward, is that right?
Yeah, I think they kind of became...
Right. I'm sorry, hold that thought. We'll be right back after this break.
Fire,
All right, we're back on the Weekend Interview Show with the special guest Jim Loeb from the Interpress Service. Sir, when we left off before the break, we were talking about how the Trotskyites took the basically the United States side during the Cold War and why exactly that was.
Right. Well, they came increasingly. Many, but by no means all, of the original neoconservatives were Jewish. Many were either came from or were the offspring of immigrants from Eastern Europe, and were very, you know, caught up in the politics of Russia and Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And of course, we're very affected as well by World War II. In the late 60s is when they start to begin moving right in a major kind of way. And I think it comes out of several influences or several events that took place at the same time. On the one hand, you had an anti-war movement. And they felt the anti-war movement could lead to a new isolationism on the part of the United States, which they thought would be particularly dangerous, particularly as they looked back on the origins of World War II and the Nazi Holocaust, that it was would be a renunciation of America's kind of global responsibilities, global moral responsibilities, and would conceivably leave Israel, for example, exposed to Soviet-backed Arab enemies. Another thing that happened at that time was, of course, the 1967 Israeli-Arab War, Six-Day War, which gave neoconservatives, those who were Jewish, a tremendous sense of pride, because here was a major... Here was kind of the warrior Jew in contrast to the victim of the Holocaust period and of the pogroms in Eastern Europe that had preceded the Holocaust itself. It gave them pride on the one hand, but on the other hand, they saw how Israel became isolated at the United Nations, and they began to turn against the United Nations and against the Third World in general for not standing by Israel, which they thought was not the aggressor. They felt that Israel had gone to war in self-defense. This becomes accentuated very much in the 73 war and the Arab oil embargo. It's shortly after that you get the Zionism is racism resolution at the UN. And this feeds the sense of isolation and persecution. And being wrong in a fundamental moral sense, that also very much sped their kind of journey to the right. And the third thing that happens in the late 60s that kind of sets them off on this course is the rise of the Black Power movement, because a lot of neoconservatives were very involved in the civil rights movement, which was seen as having an integrationist ideal, because that was essentially the experience of Jews in this country, is that they wanted to become Americans, and they saw the ideal as a kind of melting pot in which successive immigrants of which they were a part become part of this great American nation and so on. But the Black Power movement really challenged that in a very fundamental way, and it said, we don't want you Jews and other whites to lead us. We have our own kind of movement. We have our own destination. We want to be separate, particularly on university campuses where many neoconservatives taught. They wanted black studies departments, and all of this was seen as really kind of existentially threatening to neoconservatives. And it all kind of combined together. You find a lot of neoconservative attitudes toward the United Nations in the 1970s being very similar to their attitudes towards the Black Power movement in the late 60s. It all kind of mixes together and sets them off on their rightward journey.
That's interesting. I remember something, a video I saw of, it was anti-United Nations video that had Jean Kirkpatrick in it. And I know from your writings that she was part of the Social Democrats USA and is one of these neoconservatives. And it's interesting to me. I'm very opposed to the UN myself, just the fact that it exists. Whereas I guess it seems these neocons are against the UN, not so much for existing, but for not doing things their way. Is that right?
Well, I think that's right, but I think it's also more complicated than that. I mean, my tendency is to see that neocons is less of a kind of well-thought-out political philosophy and more of it's kind of more psychological. I think there are many contradictory elements in it, and I think they're explained by a kind of psychological state. But I think they see foreign policy in particular as a moral battleground between forces of good and forces of evil. They see the United States as kind of the embodiment of the forces of good. And the idea that the United States, or for that matter Israel, could be constrained by a multilateral organization in which countries or states of a lesser morality would constrain them is kind of morally unacceptable to them. It's almost immoral to be committed to following the dictates of the UN Security Council, because by definition, France, China, Russia cannot possibly be acting in as moral a fashion as the United States could. So I think their take on the UN is probably of a somewhat different quality than many people who oppose the UN from the right or from a libertarian background, in part because it has to do with a sense of moral rightness and of exceptionalism.
Okay, so in the 70s, when these guys finally pretty much abandoned the left and decided to move to the right, is this around the time they met Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld?
Yes.
Wolfowitz and Pearl, I guess I'm thinking of specifically.
Well, say Wolfowitz and Pearl, but others too. What you have is from the mid to the late 70s, the neocons begin to establish kind of strategic alliances, which are very important today. And there are two of them. One is to the anti-détente forces within the Republican Party in the mid-70s. A lot of neocons, incidentally, come out of Senator Henry Scoop Jackson's office at this time. He was head of the Armed Services Committee of the Senate at the time. Pearl worked for him. Frank Gaffney worked for him. Elliot Abrams and eventually Bill Kristol worked for him when he was running for president. In any event, Jackson was kind of allied with anti-détente forces in the Republican Party during this period, and they were taking on Henry Kissinger, who was the prime exponent of détente. They were trying to dissuade presidents, President Ford in particular, from signing a new disarmament agreement or arms control agreement with the Soviet Union, among other things. And what happened is that the neoconservatives, more or less led by Jackson at that time, formed an alliance with those who opposed it in the Republican Party, and one of them certainly was Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld becomes a key ally of theirs at this moment, around 1975, 1976. And Cheney, who was somewhat more subtle, I think, about his politics, somewhat more discreet about his politics, he was chief of staff under Ford, backs up Rumsfeld at this time. So you have that alliance formed around the mid-70s. And a lot of that alliance, incidentally, is directed not just against Kissinger, but against the CIA, who is seen by both the neoconservatives and the more traditional right wing of the Republican Party, or so we could call it the peace through strength wing, see the CIA as being soft on the Soviet Union, as being too optimistic, and they go through all kinds of hoops in order to embarrass the CIA, and argue that the Soviet Union is a much, much greater strategic threat than what the CIA has been telling the rest of the government. So that's kind of the first strategic alliance that's made between the neocons.
Well,
and the right.
It does sort of foreshadow what's been happening recently with the fight between the neocons and the Pentagon and the State Department and CIA.
Yeah, it's very, very similar. That's right. I mean, a lot of these things are very ingrained. The second strategic alliance that's formed in this period is, although it takes a little longer to kind of solidify, is between the neoconservatives, who again are predominantly but not exclusively Jewish, and the Christian right. And that's done in part because the Likud party in Israel, which came to power in 77, believes that Jimmy Carter is a real threat to their concept of a greater Israel. During the 1976 campaign, Carter talked about the Palestinians having the right to a homeland, and that was taken as meaning that Carter wanted a state, or believed there should be a Palestinian state, which then was seen as absolutely unacceptable by many Israelis and certainly by the Likud party.
All right, hang tight right there, Ms. Lowe. Yeah. We're going to go right out to commercial break, and we'll be right back.
Stopped and walked into a bar and laid his money down, but his mother's words echoed again. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
All right, we're back on the Weekend Interview Show. Our guest is Jim Loeb. He is the Washington, D.C. correspondent for the Interpress Service. Let's see, when we left off, sir, we were talking about the alliance formed between the ex-Trotskyite neoconservatives and the evangelical Christian right. Now, what is the basis of that alliance?
Yeah, it's important to say not all neoconservatives were ex-Trotskyites. Just a number of them were. The basis was that the Christian right had a very heavily what's called Christian Zionist element in it. And Christian Zionists follow a certain interpretation of the Bible that's sometimes called dispensationalism, which holds that the Kingdom of David, when it reconstitutes itself and rebuilds the original temple, and sacrifices are then carried out in the original temple, as they were, 3,000 years ago, practically, that would herald the return of Christ and the end of days. And so Christian Zionists, including Billy Graham, for that matter, believed that the creation of Israel was a sign that the end of days was at hand. And then its victory in 67, where it took the West Bank and Gaza, was seen as another sign. And the Likud party in Israel was very interested in cultivating this constituency in the United States in order, obviously, to affect U.S. politics and make it conform more to their ideas about a greater Israel and not having to compromise with Palestinians or Arabs in general. And so they set out a courtship that kind of was solidified in 1980 when then Prime Minister Menachem Begin awarded the Centennial Jabotinsky Medal to Jerry Falwell and gave him a private jet so that he would be more effective in his ministry. Neoconservatives had there was a long argument about whether Jews should be relating much to the Christian right, because it was felt that elements of Christian right doctrine were really quite explicitly anti-Semitic, pro-Israel, but anti-Jewish in a sense. But most of this dialogue took place on the pages of Commentary magazine, which has always been a kind of most important neoconservative forum since the beginning. And it kind of ended when Irving Kristol, who's one of the progenitors of neoconservatism, kind of said that, look, you know, I'm quoting now, or at least paraphrasing, it's their ideology, but it's our Israel. So the argument was kind of settled, at least on the neoconservative side, that an alliance with the Christian right was a good thing, that it would yield political dividends, particularly with respect to support for Israel. And so by the early 1980s, you really have the makings of this coalition, which is the same coalition, at least in my view, that has supported within the Bush administration this very aggressive policy in the Middle East that has culminated so far in the invasion of Iraq.
Well, and around this time, they got, what, third and fourth tier positions inside policy positions in the Reagan administration?
Well, I think they did better than that. In the first term, I would say they got second or third tier positions. The most visible was Gene Fitzpatrick. But Eugene Rostow was also working in arms and disarmament under Reagan, and Paul Nitzes kind of had an off-and-on relationship with neoconservatives, sometimes supportive, sometimes not. Richard Perle had a very important position in the Pentagon that the title didn't sound so great. It was an assistant secretary of defense, but the power was pretty significant in what he was able to do. Elliot Abrams comes to prominence during this time. He became assistant secretary for Inter-American Affairs. And there were a few others who were floating around the National Security Council. Paul Wolfowitz also holds a number of positions during this period at the second or third levels of the administration. But they became very kind of disillusioned during Reagan's term. Initially, the disillusionment was over Israel and Reagan's insistence on selling fighter aircraft and AWACS to Saudi Arabia. They strongly opposed that, and they lost that internal debate. And then when Israel invaded Lebanon, and subsequently U.S. Marines had to come in and then got kind of caught up in a crossfire, in a burgeoning civil war in Lebanon, and eventually were withdrawn, or within actually a fairly short period, they were rather precipitously withdrawn from Lebanon. A lot of neoconservatives considered that a terrible betrayal.
Now, the mistake
on Reagan's part.
The mistake wasn't intervening. The mistake was leaving too soon?
Was leaving too soon, having essentially conceded Lebanon, leaving Israel kind of up in the lurch in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, and refusing to take on Syria. They thought that was appeasement.
Okay.
Appeasement.
It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is Jim Loeb from Interpress Service. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Jim Loeb from the Interpress Service about the God help us morality-based foreign policy of the neoconservatives. So after Reagan left Beirut, you were saying that the neoconservatives complained rather loudly and began to lose influence in the Reagan administration. Is that right?
Yeah, they were pretty upset by that, but what really did it for them was the rise of Gorbachev, in the sense that Reagan really did want to resolve, felt that Gorbachev was someone he could do serious business with and even achieve a far-reaching disarmament with. The neoconservatives were among the last of the hawks to believe that Gorbachev was anything but a very cynical communist who was trying to lull the United States into a false sense of security, in which Soviet Union, or from which the Soviet Union would derive huge strategic advantages and eventual victory by the communists worldwide or whatever. They thought that Reagan betrayed a certain romanticism and an optimism and a faith in Gorbachev that they felt wasn't warranted.
Well, but then they got a new opportunity after the first Gulf War, isn't that right?
Well, they liked the idea of the first Gulf War, though they did not like George H.W. Bush at all, and he didn't really much like them. You know?
He could be counted more as like the Kissinger faction as compared to them, you think?
Very much, although I would say more closely tied to oil. But what they really didn't like about George H.W. Bush was the fact that he would pressure Israel to do any number of things, but most importantly, to basically sit down at the Madrid conference with the Arab states, even though they did not, the Likud government did not wish to do that. And the fact that Bush was willing to put pressure on Israel, and specifically on a Likud government, was taken very poorly by them. There were hardly any neoconservatives left by the time that Bush took power, but there were fewer by the time that he left, and a number of neoconservatives actually campaigned for Clinton.
Well, Paul Wolfowitz almost lost his job while he was working for George Bush Sr., right?
Well, he was one of the few neoconservatives who remained at a high level, one of the very few, in fact, unquestionably the highest, who remained within the within a Republican administration under George H.W. Bush. And he was fired, or he wasn't fired. His position was fairly tenuous because he had overseen the preparation of a draft defense policy or planning guidance, which was a kind of a five-year strategy for the United States, which leaked to the New York Times and created quite a scandal. This was in 1992, after the Gulf War.
And then this was really kind of the beginning in the long stream of policy position papers and such put forward by the neocons advocating more adventurism in the Middle East and around the world entirely, yeah, really, right?
Well, around Eurasia in particular. The DPG, the Defense Planning Guidance, that he and Libby, who became then under Vice President Cheney, his chief of staff and top national security advisor, Zalmay Khalilzad, who's now the ambassador to Afghanistan, they were all put this paper together, which essentially, that paper said that, argued essentially for that the United States should maintain control of the vital resources of the Gulf region, or really just about anywhere in the Eurasian continent, or retain the ability to deny those resources to potential rivals, because the object was to prevent the rise of any possible regional or global rival to the United States in the post-Cold War era. That was a central purpose of the strategy that was laid out in the defense planning guidance. And it became kind of the touchstone for the creation of the Project for the New American Century 5 years later, that strategy. And then the strategy, ultimately, most elements of it were codified in the National Security Strategy of the United States that was published by Bush in December of 2002.
See, it's funny to me because it sounds like the lesson learned from the Holocaust, from their point of view, that basically the American, the most moral force in the world, must have hegemony over the entire world in order to prevent any more Holocausts. And yet it was really the hegemon that caused the Holocaust. And it seems like they're setting up a situation where we become their worst nightmare.
Well, they obviously would beg to differ. I mean, you know, again, you can, it's hard to get neoconservatives to make that kind of connection that you did, but I personally believe that those connections exist. What's very typical of neoconservative thinking is in any time in which the United States, U.S. power, is challenged, they make an immediate, a reflexive, I would say a Pavlovian reference to the 1930s and the rise of Hitler and the possibility of appeasement.
Yeah, they always seem to forget the teens and America getting involved in World War I and tipping the balance and setting the stage for Hitler in the first place. That part, I guess history begins in the 1930s, right?
Well, I think history for them is largely the 1930s and 40s. I think almost every situation simply recalls that. And, you know, to some extent, this is true of liberal interventionists. And actually, I consider myself something of a liberal interventionist. But I remember it was Madeleine Albright who said, you know, that some people see Vietnam as kind of their reference point in history, but others see Munich as their reference point in history. Well, the neoconservatives see Munich really as the only reference point in history.
I see the sinking of the Lusitania as the reference point in history.
Yeah, but it was long ago for them, and you know, in their eyes, they the Holocaust really has to be seen as the kind of the decisive event in their parents and in their lives, and they, and I can understand why. I mean, my parents were German Jews and fled Germany in the 30s, and clearly, the Holocaust has an enormous influence on the way that I see things. I just derive very different lessons from that experience than the neocons do. And but it still looms as a huge event. Also, as I said, for liberal internationalists, I think for John Kerry even. Or people like him who feel that there is a moral component to foreign policy, that you can't leave people who are being oppressed and massacred and killed and subject to genocide and so on. You can't, there has to be some responsibility taken for that. I think that's part of what this is about, but in my own view, the lesson they take from it is just very different from the ones that I do.
Okay, so on the election, whatever you want to call it, the taking of office of George W. Bush, his vice president Dick Cheney basically picked all of these neoconservatives and put them all in high power positions inside the Pentagon and State Department too, right?
Well, in State Department, much less so, because Powell had a good deal more influence over who could be chosen, and Powell, like George H.W. Bush, and going back to Henry Kissinger, was a realist thinker in foreign policy who was very uncomfortable with the kind of much more radical views held by the neoconservatives as to what the U.S. role should be in the world. So
I like that term, That's bandied about a lot, the realists versus the neoconservatives, but when I look at, like, say, for example, the Clinton years, there wasn't too much realism going on there. It was all very ideological, wasn't it?
I think ultimately...
Serbia and Madeleine Albright's comments about it doesn't matter how many Iraqi kids die because the price is worth it, et cetera.
Well, that would be a very realistic remark, realist remark. That is, you know, sometimes you have to be cruel to be kind. I think there were elements of idealism, of liberal interventionism, if you like, or for that matter, neoconservative interventionism, because in the case of the Balkans, the neoconservatives were in the forefront of people calling for intervention. But I think overall what you saw was a pretty realistic foreign policy. I mean, they really didn't do anything very radical apart from those interventions, which really, surprisingly, in some way have been made easier by George H.W. Bush's intervention in Somalia, that was really a major break in, right. in U.S. foreign policy.
I guess I see this split in sort of a different perspective. I see more, well, like Max Boot, he's, I guess, one of these official neoconservatives over at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says this is hard Wilsonianism. This is, we're Wilsonians, but we really mean it, and we'll kill you.
You mean about neoconservatives?
Yeah. Wilsonians.
I think the Wilsonian part is completely misconstrued. And I wrote an article recently in the Daily Star in Beirut on this particular issue. I'm amazed at how the foreign policy establishment has accepted that neoconservatives are hard Wilsonians or are Wilsonians or that they're really big on democracy. I know the rhetoric has always been very big on democracy, but frankly, I see very little evidence over the years that they've given a lot of, that they think that's what the United States should be devoted to. I think their interests are much smaller and, again, have more to do with psychology. I think it's very difficult. I mean, for example, the neoconservatives have no problems with Islam Karimov, the president of Uzbekistan, who is an absolutely typical, you know, autocrat. I mean, there's no other way to describe him. And if they're serious about democracy in the Middle East or in the Islamic world, why don't they ever talk about Uzbekistan? They don't, because in certain calculations, they're really quite realist in their approach. If you've got an anti-democrat or an autocrat or worse, a real thug, who's willing to do your bidding in foreign policy, and in many neocons' case, that means having very good relations with a Likud government in Israel, they're not going to bother you. They're not going to raise hell about your being undemocratic. So I think this pretension of Wilsonianism is window dressing, essentially. I don't think there's much behind it. I don't think that's what's going on here. And they're certainly not Wilsonian in the sense that Wilson favored multilateralism because neocons despise multilateralism. So I think both in the notion that they believe in democracy and spreading democracy. I think that's for rhetorical purposes only, or for the purposes of mobilizing public opinion behind them. And with respect to the United Nations or multilateralism, they're anti-Wilsonian. So I just don't buy that characterization.
So what is their real goal, then, of remaking the Middle East? I mean,
I think the real goal of remaking the Middle East is to, I mean, and they write this in their own writings. This is not like, you know, like some say they consider it neocons a kind of covert conspiracy. And no, I think their writings are very clear and they're very open about the writings. It's to affect the balance of power in the Arab world in particular.
In favor of
Israel and whoever Israel is allied with at the moment. What's remarkable in my mind is that this Iraq adventure, I think, has not only altered the balance of power in ways that are unfavorable to the United States. I think they've altered the balance of power in ways that are very unfavorable to Israel as well. I mean, until the invasion of Iraq, Turkey was a solid ally of Israel. Even if people didn't talk about it much, the fact is they had a military alliance. Now, the military alliance continues on a pro forma basis, but Turkish opinion has been completely transformed over the last year and a half. And it's outspokenly anti-Israel and increasingly anti-Semitic, which is really alarming. And I know even Likud party people are very, very worried about that.
Did these neoconservatives believe their own lies? I mean, I'm so cynical that I never really believed a word they said, but it seems it's at least plausible that these people actually really believe their own BS about how welcome they would be there and how easy the occupation would be and all that. Do you think that's true, or were they just setting us up because they want our military there on a permanent basis so it can go on further adventures after this?
I think both are true. they engaged in a lot of wishful thinking, and that was reinforced by groupthink, because neocons are really a very insular group of people, and they don't welcome criticism or outside opinions that disagree with them, and that's been something that's been true of them for a very long time. And I think they probably came to believe certain things just by creating by putting out various points of view and theses, and then hearing them echoed back in the media and saying, well, then it must be true, kind of, and talking with each other a lot. So I think some are probably somewhat more cynically, are more cynical and probably didn't believe as much, but others, I think, really did believe it. I think, for example, Paul Wolfowitz, who's really not a very typical neocon because his views, for example, on Palestinians tend to be much more liberal than most neocons. I think he believes when he talks about transforming the Middle East and making it more democratic and so on.
All right, hang tight. It's the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back.
Oh, I'd love to wear a rainbow every day and tell the world that everything's okay. But I'll try to carry off a little darkness on my back till things are brighter. I'm the man in black.
Hey, everybody. Scott Horton here, trying my best off the cuff to make up a commercial for my new company, TheBumperSticker.com. We have over 275-something slogans up there, including Visualize World Tyranny, Bill Clinton, No Longer the Worst President in American History, I Still Can't Decide Who I'm Least Against, and on like that. Also, if you know any candidates who are running for office, who are not Republicans or Democrats, who are not taking any federal funds for their campaign, i.e., if you know any libertarians running for office, then check out the LibertarianMarketplace.com. We can make all the signs and bumper stickers and everything you need for your campaign, and you don't have to buy 1,000 to get the cheap price. We could sell you 4 for the super discount. So check out TheBumperSticker.com and TheLibertarianMarketplace.com. All right, everybody, we're back on the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and my guest is Jim Loeb. And, Jim, if people wanted to read what you write, where would they go?
Well, they can Google me. It's probably the easiest thing to do. There is a website that Interpress that includes all of my writing on neoconservatives or the neoconservative ascendancy, from just before 9/11, I think. But I offhand don't. You could go to ipsnews.net and try to find your way there. If you hold on for just a sec, I can probably get the site. Another thing, but I think Googling is probably the easiest thing because I write for other outlets as well.
Right. There's an archive of your writings at antiwar.com too, right?
Some of them, I guess. I've never checked that out, actually, I'll tell you.
Well, that's where
probably,
I read you.
Yeah, okay. I can give you the website of all the stuff I've written for IPS anyway, which is about almost 200 stories, I think, over the last few years.
And going back and, you know, writing about the neocons long before September 11th, back when they were urging Clinton to invade Iraq.
Well, to some extent, yeah, although I was really interested in them in the late 70s and early 80s, too, but I don't think you can find that on the net. The website is www.ipsnews.net/focus/neocons, and that's hyphenated, neocons, /index.as, as in Sam, P, as in Peter.
Great. And I guess... Well, I didn't want to get too much into your, like, personal opinion about stuff too much, but I guess I'm interested to know what you think about the upcoming presidential election and whether you have any, there's somebody that you like a little bit better than the other, or maybe you're least against.
Oh, no, well, I mean, as a reporter, I can't really say one way or the other. But I do think this is a very important election in the sense that if George W. Bush is reelected and if neocons find themselves with even half as much influence as they've had in the first term, I think certain very large global movements will click in and there will be no going back. I think it'll be very difficult for anybody to go back from the situation we find ourselves in, particularly vis-a-vis the Islamic world, but also vis-a-vis our allies in Europe. But I don't see how they would go back under a second George W. Bush term. So that probably gives you some indication of my feelings on the matter.
Okay, well, I'm actually really worried. I read something not too long ago that just killed me about how Michael Moore and Richard Pearl are in agreement on Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And how, like, you know, hey, would you left-wingers please shut up and stop encouraging them? Because the more people complain about the Saudis, the more they're playing into the hands of the most war hawks in the Bush administration. Oh, we're out of time. Running my mouth up until the very end. Thank you very much, Jim Loeb, for coming on my show. I really appreciate having you for my first guest.
Well, I hope it worked out well.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's the weekend interview show. We'll be right back.